Diabetes Insights, Breakthroughs and Innovators. The EASD TV podcast from the annual meeting of the European Association for the Study of Diabetes.
Hello, you're watching EASD TV. My name is Vivian Parry, and we come to one of our most popular sessions on EASD TV. This is where we look at futures. This session, we're looking at the future of type 1 diabetes. And with me, who better than Chantal Mathieu? And if any of you were at the opening ceremony, I know lots of you were, you will have heard her make a very inspirational speech this morning. Also with us in the studio, we have Peter Rossing of the University of Copenhagen and Rory McKinnon of the University of Dundee. So, Chantal, I guess we can put this into sections. So, can we think about prevention, first of all? Because you said very powerfully that you thought that in your lifetime we would see prevention of all sorts of diabetes.
Including type 1.
Including type 1.
Yes.
That's a bold statement.
I know, and I mean it. Because now we are getting really quite a good picture on how to identify people who are in the early stages of T1D, namely who are attacking the beta cell with the immune system. So their own immune system is autoimmune and goes and attacks the insulin-producing beta cell. We know that this is happening when people have in their blood antibodies against the beta cell. And so now we have signatures of these antibodies where we know that if you have two or more types of these autoantibodies, you have an 80, 90% chance of moving to clinical, what we now call stage 3 T1D, in contrast to these early stages where we talk about stage 1 and when there's a little bit of this glycemia stage 2. So we can identify now people in early stages of T1D when there's still 80, 90% of beta cells to be saved, in contrast to what we're doing now, namely at the time of clinical diagnosis of T1D stage 3, 70, 80% of beta cells are already destroyed. And so if we can identify people in early stages, we can also start introducing our disease-modifying therapies, where we know that if we give them at stage 3, so when only 20, 30% of beta cells are left, they can affect the course of destruction of the beta cell. I'm talking about therapies like anti-TNF, like a JAK inhibitor, baricitinib, but also teplizumab, an antibody against CD3, and perhaps many, many more that are still being tested. So if we could now bring these interventions that have some effect in stage 3, because there's only few beta cells to be saved, to earlier stages, we might save more beta cells and have a prevention of type 1.
And what we're seeing is big trials in several countries in Europe, which are screening children. And initially, that was all about trying to prevent, you know, crisis admissions of children to hospital when they did develop type 1. But actually, now we're turning it around with these therapies in view, it might be possible to prevent their diabetes from developing.
Yes, so for the moment, as I said, we're able to diagnose people in early stages of T1D. It is in many countries of Europe already a habit to screen family members of people with type 1 diabetes for presence of autoantibodies. But now in many countries, we're rolling out to the general population. We're coordinating a project called Identify, where we're testing how this should best be done in our different healthcare systems in Europe. We're testing in Czechia, in Poland, Scandinavia, Germany, UK, for instance, how to screen, what age to screen, what is the best yield to pick up these people in early stages of T1D. First of all, to do exactly what you say, namely to give people a soft landing, to give them education and accompaniment for the moment when they get to this clinical stage of T1D stage 3, and thus avoid diabetic ketoacidosis. But as I said, the trials we're doing now with disease-modifying therapies in stage 3 to try and preserve the little bit of beta cells we still have we hope to bring them very soon to earlier stages. And that's why we created this platform in Europe called Inodia. The website is inodia.org, where we are training clinical sites to become clinical trial centers in order to be able to really roll out all of these intervention trials much more rapidly and get to this prevention of type 1.
And I was very excited to see a vaccine being developed against Coxsackie B virus. Yep. I mean, that would be, it's gone in phase one trials at the moment, but that would be so exciting if we're able, for instance, to vaccinate babies at an early stage.
And that's yet another stage where we hopefully one day will get to. Namely, now you're talking about interventions in everybody. You know, a vaccination against enteroviruses in early age, at baby age, could not only prevent these diarrhea episodes, but also the initiation of autoimmune disease. So it's even before type 1 diabetes is present. It's really there, prevention of any autoimmune attack against the beta cell. So this is really primary prevention, and that could be administered to the general population if it proves to be safe. And then we even prevent any autoimmune attack. And so I cross my fingers that indeed these vaccines can be developed, because there is a good hypothesis coming from Scandinavia to say that enteroviruses do play a role as triggers for the autoimmune system, for the autoimmune immune system to go and attack the beta cell.
It is very, very exciting times. What are you excited about, Rory, in terms of the future of type 1 diabetes?
Well, I think there is so much to be excited about at the moment. You've just heard about the potential for disease-modifying therapies, and this is really the first time we've had this potential in type 1 diabetes. And as Chantal has said, prevention is always better than cure.
Yes, and of course, type 2 has really dominated everything with its new therapeutics. And so at last, type 1 is getting a look in.
Absolutely. Invariably, because of the number of people with type 2 diabetes, affects all of our healthcare systems and the cost related to that. But I think now, for instance, I think the rapid advance in technologies over the last decade has been really quite phenomenal as we move to hybrid closed loop and full closed loop. So we transform just not just the care of people with type 1 diabetes, but also how we run our clinics, how we manage people remotely now increasingly, allowing us to really work with people in their homes as much as anything else. So I think these type of technologies are fantastic. We're also looking increasingly at other ways in which we can intervene to help prevent disease. I know Peter is very expert on this particular area, but how we can use drugs that have been developed for type 2 diabetes in type 1 diabetes to prove outcomes from kidney.
Yeah, that's a very interesting development. You're seeing a lot of that, I've noted in several sessions, talking about, you know, the kind of double diabetes and, you know, being able to use some of those disease-modifying type 2 drugs in type 1.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we're increasingly aware that there are benefits of these drugs in people without diabetes, let alone in those with type 1 and type 2. Now, there have been reasons why we haven't prescribed some of these drugs, particularly the group called the SGLT2 inhibitors, because of the increased risk of diabetic ketoacidosis. But I think we're also now developing management strategies where we can mitigate against this risk, and these drugs have added benefit. I think that we have to recognize that reality still is that the majority of people with type 1 diabetes are not at target. So even with these advanced therapeutics, we're not getting people the type of glycemic targets we need them to be to prevent these complications. And so additional therapies are really helpful in this context.
Peter, what's making your heart beat faster, particularly as you've gone through the various presentations?
I'm very excited for the developments in type 1 diabetes, as we just heard about. And if they are successful, I'm out of job because I work with late complications to diabetes, and I would love to be out of job for that reason. But on the other hand, you can say it will take some time before this is successful and implemented. And even with the developments we see in technology, there are still people having diabetes and not reaching targets. So we really need to focus on the late complications of type 1 diabetes as well, because that's a prevalent problem. We see that kidney disease, cardiovascular complications, they're actually just as prevalent in type 1 as in type 2 diabetes. So we really need not to forget this and try to mitigate that risk. And of course, that's about blood pressure and cholesterol as non-smoking, as for everybody else. But the opportunity that you just discussed, what about all the drugs that we have seen work in type 2 diabetes on organ protection, on cardiovascular benefit and kidney benefit? We need to try that, not for the glucose-lowering effect, but for the organ protective effect, because that seems to be independent of the glucose-lowering effect. So what we have just started this summer is Steno 1 trial, which is kind of like modeled after Steno 2 trial, which was a long time ago, but which was multifactorial intervention in type 2 diabetes, reducing cardiovascular complications and mortality. Now we do it in type 1, therefore Steno 1. And that's about optimizing treatment of the risk factors, and then you can choose finerenone, non-steroidal mineralocorticoid receptor antagonist, or semaglutide, a GLP-1 receptor agonist, or sotagliflozin, an SGLT inhibitor, based on the phenotype of the patient. So it's people with type 1 diabetes with high risk, either based on their profile, age, or previous history of cardiovascular or kidney disease. And then they can have one or several of these agents that worked in type 2, but that we need to treat in type 1 or test in type 1. And there are side effects or concerns, for instance, ketoacidosis with the SGLT inhibitors. But I think the risk-benefit ratio is very different when we talk about treating or preventing complications than when we talk about optimizing glycemic control, which is, of course, also important, but could perhaps be done in different ways. But treating the complications, I think we have unique opportunities here. So we'll do that in a large trial across Denmark with the collaboration of everybody dealing with type 1 diabetes in Denmark. And hopefully in 5 years' time, we have an answer.
So Chantal, you are the busiest person on the planet at this moment because you're everywhere. But I know you've probably had a chance to look at the program beforehand. What have you picked out as being particularly important in type 1 that might impact its future?
I actually like the fact that we got a late-breaking abstract on islet transplantation. Because again, that to me was one of the missing links. We did the islet transplantation many, many years ago, and there was always this hurdle that we couldn't get enough islets to transplant in a person to get an adult person insulin independent. Of course, we also need immune suppression. But so this first hurdle of not getting enough beta cells from cadaveric pancreases was to me the death sentence of islet transplantation as a potential solution for people with type 1. Now, many, many laboratories, several laboratories and industries are able to make islets with a fairly natural composition, looking like natural islets from embryonic stem cells. And so now we've just crossed out this first hurdle. Namely, we can make kilos, liters of islets. So we can also manipulate these islets. We can make them less appetizable, you know, nice for the immune system so that they may attack these new islets less, these immune cells. So this opens a really new future. Not only will I be able to eventually see the prevention, but perhaps also the cure. Because imagine if you can have manipulated islets that are more resistant against immune attack or are less appealing to this immune system. Yeah, we may get away with applying these disease-modifying therapies that we've used in newly diagnosed or pre-diabetic individuals to then also use in islet transplantation. So that really excited me. Of course, the whole, all the technology sessions, there will be a consensus released on what to do with all of our hybrid closed loop systems in exercise, because that's not easy. All these systems are different. Also, exercise is different, whether you run or whether you play a basketball match or whether you swim, it's all different. So that consensus I'm really looking forward to. Also, the pregnancy in type 1 sessions are interesting. So yeah, plenty of stuff.
There's plenty of stuff. Anything else you want to mention, either of you two?
Well, I would just say that I think there are some good sessions on type 1 cardiovascular disease at this meeting, and that's something I don't think we've seen much of in the past. The major focus, of course, has been on type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular disease. Are the mechanisms the same? Are they different? Are there different types of therapies that we need to have in order to prevent, to diagnose early and to prevent, for instance, heart failure or significant coronary artery disease in type 1? So I think there's lots of different areas to come forward, and also on muscles. You know, not surprisingly, the type 1 population are increasing in size, as are the rest of society, with the median BMI, I think, around 28 now for people with type 1 diabetes. So fatty liver disease is becoming a problem in a population where we never really thought to consider it in the past. So I think there's lots of things we need to look at and are emerging in this conference, which
and
is really great to
see. And also, I see cancer in type 1 being tackled, which I think was not something that was discussed in the past.
No, and again, we're now, with our tools, allowing people with type 1, fortunately, to live long and full lives. Meaning that all the other stuff comes out now, like cancer. And indeed, with type 2, we know that this is a major a risk factor for specific cancers, but we're picking up now that also our people with type 1 diabetes do have increased risks. So, yeah.
Anything else you've spotted?
I think the focus on the cardiovascular disease or the complications to type 1, is it the same or not, I think is very important. And I like to see that here in the meeting. And we'll have a wonderful symposium or session where we'll discuss this. And I think that will be one of many very nice sessions on type 1.
Can I add one thing?
You're allowed. You're the president. You're allowed.
I'm also extremely excited that we have so many good basic research presentations.
Yes, I've noticed that. They're very good.
Yeah, studying.
And also, the thing that I think is just so noticeable at this meeting, the number of young researchers.
Oh, yes.
I mean, it's...
Yeah.
I feel old sometimes.
Yeah, well... But so having this mixture, because we talk mainly clinical development, but these really very good bioinformatic analysis, proteome of beta cells under immune attack, what have you, I think that's also really very exciting. There's some super research being presented here.
So I'm going to ask you each for one word to describe the future of type 1 diabetes. I'm going to start with Chantal.
Bright.
Fantastic.
I'll second bright. I think it's looking really good.
Fantastic. Well, I would say it's very rosy indeed. It's absolutely wonderful to hear so much about type 1 and actually to really be genuinely talking about actual prevention. We'll be back soon on EASD TV.
Thank you for joining us on the podcast of the European Association for the Study of Diabetes. We hope you enjoyed today's insights. If you did, go ahead and hit subscribe and you'll always stay up to date with the latest in diabetes research and discoveries. And if you'd like to dive deeper, you can find plenty more information at EASD.org.